Okay, good afternoon, everybody. Thank you so much for coming out to Comic Book Legal Defense Fund 25 Years of Protecting Creativity panel. I'm Charles Brownstein. I'm the executive director of the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund, and today we're going to talk about the history of the organization and the various fights that we've had. Before I get moving, I'm hoping that our room crew can bring the lights down maybe about 50% so the PowerPoint shows up a bit better. How's that, folks? Can you see it okay? Okay, great. So here we are. We're the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund, and we're a not-for-profit organization dedicated to the protection of the First Amendment rights of the comics art form and its community of retailers, creators, publishers, librarians, and readers. We provide legal referrals, representation, advice, assistance, and education in the furtherance of those goals. The First Amendment is the baseline of our republic, and it's really the baseline of all creative art. And for many years, comic books were regarded as a subpar medium that did not deserve protection or was somehow seen to be exempt from those protections because it was of low value. And the value of speech is something that's come and gone over the years as a legal argument. But it all needs to be protected. And the First Amendment, it can never hurt to familiarize yourself with it enough. It reads, "Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press, or of the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances." And you might look at me and go, "Okay, guy, why are you reading the script off of the PowerPoint?" Well, because many people talk about the First Amendment and they talk about their rights, but they don't really get to the core of the document and how the law affects us all. The First Amendment basically says that the government can't come in arbitrarily and tell you what to create or what to think or what to read. It's guaranteed there. And over time, there are always groups that are looking to pull back against what people are able to say. And we've got to stand firm and fight for a full, robust range of speech, because as you'll discover over the course of this talk, sometimes you got to defend the fringes of art to help art to grow. The First Amendment guaranteeing the right to expression makes sure that nobody can be prosecuted for speaking their beliefs. There's always controversial ideas that need to be that are contested, and the CBLDF fights those battles where comics are contested. Comics were controversial kind of from the start. They began as a popular art form in the 1930s, developing out of the newspapers and being reprinted in reprint publications, and then developing out as their own genre. And there were people who immediately decided that they were a corruptive influence on youth. And there was a public outcry that led to comics burnings in the 1940s and ultimately greater challenges in the 1950s. First, the burnings of comics and the challenges against comics led the industry to attempt to regulate itself in a way to deal with the challenges it was facing. There was an organization that didn't work out called the Association of Comic Magazine Publishers that was formed in 1948 to prevent the publication of what they called sexy, wanton comics. Basically, anything that was suggestive, anything that was violent was prohibited under this code. But ultimately, it failed because there wasn't enough participation. Publishers came in unevenly, and it just didn't work as a self-regulatory code, and so challenges to the art form continued. And they continued principally under the icon of Dr. Frederick Wortham, who probably remains the most iconic opponent of comics. He was well-meaning, he just was evil. And I don't think that he intended to be regarded as evil. He was a child psychologist who maintained that comics were a corruptive influence, but it was junk science. He worked at a hospital where he was studying at-risk kids, and they all read comic books, but he had no control group, right? So he wrote articles against comics, and he wrote ultimately a iconic famous book called The Seduction of the Innocent. That I totally agree with. Which just vilified the medium and read things into it that weren't there. The homosexuality of Batman, the sexiness of... I'll take questions at the end. The inappropriate sexiness of panels taken out of context. And ultimately, Wortham's arguments were quite persuasive to the culture of the moment, which was coming out of World War II and looking to create a wholesome environment for the boom of young people that were coming up. And it made a lot of false arguments. It talked about how comics were strictly for kids, but you look at the history and you see that actually, you know, a full, I believe, 25% of printed matter going to GI bases in the war were comic books. You know, there were a lot of young people in their 20s that were service people that, you know, were reading this stuff, and they came back and they had an appetite for things like the EC comics and the crime comics that were popular. So Wortham basically gave an argument that would be like saying we should eradicate television because at night adults watch police procedurals, and really it should all be Saturday morning My Little Pony cartoons. This led to sentiment that put comics ultimately on trial. And we see this most iconically in the Estes-Kefauver subcommittee hearings, the Senate subcommittee hearings on comics and juvenile delinquency. And this was a moment where comic books were scrutinized as whether to discover whether or not they had a affirmative effect on juvenile delinquency and whether there was a link. And in the most famous of the testimony, Dr. Wortham, who was treated with kid gloves by the Senate, reiterated his book and talked about how comic books were read by all of these kids who are at risk, and therefore they were warped by comics. And probably the most detrimental element of this is that the publisher of EC Comics, William Gaines, who made Tales from the Crypt and Shock Suspense stories, and probably some very high watermarks for comic art, voluntarily took the stand, and he really blew it. And he blew it for all of us. And I don't mean to villainize Bill Gaines, because he was a great hero of free expression, he was a great hero of artistic expression, but also the guy had his flaws, and among his flaws is that when comics were being targeted, he was the guy that went up on the stand and said, under the influence of diet pills that were wearing off, that the comic book depicting a severed head of a woman and an axe in her killer's hand was in good taste for the cover of a horror comic. And that argument was taken out of context and plastered on the front page of the New York Times next day as comics publisher says gruesome art in good taste for children. And it just further fueled the panic and the fire of panic against comics. And this led directly to the industry realizing that we have such toxic and hostile public opinion against us that the only way we're going to survive is to create stringent self-regulation. And so, picking up where the failed ACMP left off, the Comics Magazine Association of America was formed and created the Comics Code Authority. And the code was created in a way that it thoroughly sanitized comics, completely eliminating crime and horror comics. But, again, it allowed the industry to keep the lights on. So now that the code is effectively dead and we can look back at it through history, we can see that there was a tremendously detrimental impact on the art form. And we saw a tremendous decimation of the creative talent and creativity going into the field. But we also saw that the field endured. And that was, unfortunately, one of the prices the industry felt it had to pay, was to create a stringent sanitizing influence that would ensure that children could read it. Actually, I'm going to go back one. The thing with the code, however, is that it made comics so safe that it also fueled a stigma. So coming out of the 1950 subcommittee hearings, comics were regarded as tawdry pieces of trash, not even literature, just trash culture for people of low moral character and low intelligence. And it developed a stigma that persisted really until recent years, and that created the atmosphere that required the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund to come to be. The code sanitizing comics really kept that art form at the level of what was appropriate for young people until the late 1960s. And at that point, that's when you began to see the underground comics industry come to be. The undergrounds were developed in large part by the children of the EC era. There was a program that I moderated several years ago with the creators of Zap Comics, S. Clay Wilson and Spain Rodriguez and Ron Turner and Don Donahue. And Rodriguez and Wilson were saying, we were young guys and we were reading ECs, and one month they were there and one month they were gone, and we didn't know what happened, but that was the stuff we loved. And so when they became young adults and started making their own comic books, they picked up a lot of the aesthetics of the EC period, and they and like-minded publishers like Print Mint, Last Gasp, Kitchen Sink, and Rip Off created an industry that distributed through the head shops, which were the specialist shops for paraphernalia and other hippie culture items, and made comics that spoke frankly of subjects from the serious to the scatological. And they also baited the culture of the day as well. Zap Comics was the standard bearer for undergrounds, and in their fourth issue, they decided, let's all get together and really test the boundaries of this thing. We've got all the freaks reading it. We've got all of the kids on Haight-Ashbury and all of the kids in New York and all of the kids in the Midwest who are interested in counterculture reading our stuff, and let's really see what we can do. And so Robert Crumb created a brutal satire of the 1950s, 1960s American family called Joe Blow, which was about an incestuous family who looked squeaky clean and perfect out in public, but behind closed doors were involved in filthy, perverted, incestuous sex. And the point of the comic was to point out the hypocrisy of the culture and to do it in a taboo and humorous fashion. New York State was not amused and attacked a underground store for selling the comic, and it ultimately became the first comic to be convicted of obscenity and was banned in New York State. While the undergrounds were fighting the code, the mainstream were fighting for their First Amendment rights. The mainstream was starting to push back a bit against the comic book code, and through a marvelous miscommunication between the code and the rest of the world, in 1971, at the request of the government, Stan Lee wrote a three-issue arc of Spider-Man depicting drug use, which was in violation of the comics code because you weren't allowed to depict the use of drugs, and there were certain criminal acts that you weren't allowed to depict. So they went and published it without the code. And at the same time, other comics are pushing the boundaries and speaking to the issues of the day, resulting in the code being revised in 71. And between the undergrounds and the mainstream pushing back, you started to see some of the infantilization of the medium roll back a bit. You were starting to see that it was becoming a little bit safer for comics to start speaking to grown-up audiences, and a little bit safer for comics to start talking about things that mattered, as opposed to flying around the universe fighting giant gorillas. All of this was happening in an environment where the law was changing. And so while the undergrounds were pushing forward, the 1973 obscenity test pushed them back and pushed them down. This is a ruling by the Supreme Court in this case called Miller versus California to define obscenity as subject to local standards. It reads, the Miller test holds obscene materials are defined as those that the average person applying contemporary community standards find, taken as a whole, appeal to the prurient interest of sex and that lack literary, artistic, political, or scientific value. This is really, really important because previously there wasn't guidance that enabled a community to determine explicitly what it found to be obscene, and this created a big panic across the media. And in undergrounds, which were really shifting tens of thousands of units every time there was a new issue of a Crumb comic or a new issue of Zap or a new issue of a Wilson comic getting put out there. You know, this created a serious scare in the shops that were selling it, because they've got a comic like Bizarre Sex coming out, and they're in a small community, and they see, geez, these guys in New York got busted for Zap, and that's New York City. I'm in Chicago, I'm in Iowa City, I'm in Santa Cruz. I don't know if I want to carry this stuff and risk my local community decided that I'm an obscenity peddler. I'm already selling drug paraphernalia. You know what? The hell with it. I'm getting out of this. And so you saw that the obscenity test and the Miller ruling had partially an effect on really decimating that line of creativity. So after Miller versus California, content businesses all over the country were bracing for combat. It wasn't just the comics world either. There was the formation of the Media Coalition, a group of trade associations that got together to defend the rights of media, and this included people like the American Library Association and the MPAA and the Recording Industry Associations, because there was a real fear that communities would use this to flush out anything that would whip up a moral panic. In the comics world, the undergrounds were pushed under, and the mainstream comics weren't doing that well either. The newsstand industry was collapsing, but what you started to see was the development of serious fandom. And so conventions like this one, except on much smaller scales and in much more primitive environments, came about and created a space where the appreciation of comic books was encouraged. And so you had places where underground comics and mainstream comics were side by side, and the creators were side by side, and there was a group of people that were breaking out of the mold of seeing that comics were some, you know, low disposable art form and really taking them seriously. And this led to the creation of the direct sales market, which is where ultimately a lot of the battles for free speech in comics were fought, and fought by the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund. As comics continued to mutate in the 70s, we also saw that the fandom that started going to the conventions and cherishing the material were creating an environment where comics could start speaking to more adult audiences and could start once again getting back into adult subject matter and topics. And so you saw that the direct specialty stores would start buying things not just like some of the undergrounds, but that DC would start doing things like Swamp Thing by Alan Moore, and the time was right for works like Watchmen to come to be. So mainstream houses were pushing the envelope, and indie publishers were also starting out, and you had books like ElfQuest being self-published and Cerebus being self-published that were not just creating disposable cartoons for people in their teens, but were really aspiring to seriously push forward comics and seriously speak to adult sensibilities. This was also quite important with Contract with God, Will Eisner's book that first coined popularly the use of the term graphic novel, and again depicted topics that could put somebody at risk. There's a story in there called The Super involving a really horrible apartment super and a manipulative young girl who attempts to get him into trouble by exposing herself. And, you know, that depiction of manipulation and nudity. There's another story that deals with a young man's sexual coming of age. That depiction of sexuality was a real shock in comics, coming from an elder statesman who basically said, look, we can talk about the serious things that matter. And so in concert with the economy changing, the content was changing as well. This all really came to a head in 1986 when comics advanced and we saw the release of the what we now look back on as the great troika of the graphic novels that introduced this brave new era: Mouse, The Dark Knight Returns, and Watchmen. And I think a big case can be made that we're looking back at them at the great troika in hindsight, because a lot of things were trying and pushing at the boundaries. But those books dealing as they did with political subject matter and serious historical subject matter were the items that got comics paid attention to. And so you had a famous Rolling Stone piece saying comics grew up, and that this is a really important field. I think it also contributed to people scrutinizing comics differently, because later that year, legal challenges against these grown-up stories that were being touted in the mainstream media would begin. The first arrest occurred 25 years ago, almost, on November 18, 1986, in Lansing, Illinois, when a police officer walked into Friendly Frank's comic book store, an undercover police officer, and arrested the store manager, the clerk Michael Coria, who sold him some comics from the adult section of the store. So an adult undercover police officer walks into a comic book store, picks out some comic books designed for an adult in a section of the store designed for adult readers, takes them up to the adult cashier, purchases them, and then comes back and handcuffs the guy for selling obscene materials. And there was nobody there to stand up for him. So he fought as well as he could on his own and was found guilty by the state of Illinois and fined $750 and sentenced to a year in court, sentenced to court supervision for 1 year. And the comics at issue, things we now regard as classics of the art form, ElfQuest, comics by Robert Crumb, and then some other comics of just general adult interest, things like Larry Wells' sex comic Cherry Pop-Tart. Whether you like the stuff or not, should be legal for an adult to buy, but the arguments that were being used in the court and that were being promulgated by the media and their police at that time is that this stuff is in a medium that's for kids, and it has no business being there. They're trying to corrupt our kids by putting these sick stories in a context that's going to reach them. Dennis Kitchen was the publisher of one of the comics that was part of the sting, a comic called Omaha the Cat Dancer. And that was a comic, anthropomorphic comic, about a group of adults coming through their lives. And it was had a lot of sexuality, but it also had very serious literary value. And so Frank called Dennis and had told him the story about how the conviction was coming and how much money it was costing. And Dennis decided that, hey, this isn't right. I'm the publisher here. There's artists here. We've really got to do something to help this guy, because if he goes down in flames, it's really going to affect everybody. There's going to be a bad precedent. And so he organized a group of artists and printers and distributors together to create a benefit portfolio that raised the money for the appeal. All of these works were donated, and you saw people including Will Eisner, Frank Miller, Steve Bissett, Sergio Aragonés, and Don Simpson contribute. Over there on the slide, you see the cover to it by Howard Cruz. This was really unprecedented. There was, in the 1950s, we folded and closed shop against each other. We saw one of our publishers go up on the stand and say stupid things inadvisably, and instead of, you know, standing up and saying, well, come on, let's talk together and fix this, we closed ranks. And here, Kitchen, looking at that precedent and all of these artists seeing that precedent, got together and decided, no, we've got to stand up to this kind of intimidation. We hired Burton Joseph, who was one of the founders of the Media Coalition and a real veteran of great First Amendment battles. He was involved in the National Socialist Party of America versus the Village of Skokie. He was a founding member of the Playboy Foundation and just worked tirelessly advancing the cause of free speech. He saw this case and went, what are you kidding? This stuff is absolutely protected by the First Amendment. And using his years of history, gravitas, and knowledge, went in and stridently won the appeal. Burt would go on to be our counsel until his death in 2010. All of this basically resulted in the birth of the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund. After the legal battle in Friendly Frank's resolved successfully, Dennis reasoned that there would very likely continue to be cases of this nature, and so with the few grand that were left after the appeal, he decided to set up the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund as a permanent concern. And so with a modest war chest he set to work, and eventually we were incorporated formally in 1990 and continue to work to this day, keeping watch over the First Amendment rights of the comic book industry. Part of the fund's mandate, going back to the beginning, is that there's a lot of cases you don't see. There are efforts that we've done where back in the 80s and up to this day, a police officer intimidates a store and says, you shouldn't be selling this stuff. We'll reach out to our counsel. It was Burke Joseph before, it's Bob Kornrevere now, and write a letter on that letterhead saying, here's the First Amendment. You might be familiar with it, you might not, but it says that these guys have a right to sell this. And many times those cases go away at the first sign of our letter or at the first phone call. From our inception, we've helped dozens of retailers and artists who called us at the first sign of trouble, and the important thing is to call us at the first sign of trouble. So if you or your retailer or anybody in your community have a First Amendment emergency, your first call needs to be to us, 1-800-99-CVLDF, and we'll spring into action. After the early case with Friendly Franks, there were a variety of store busts that went away because of our swift action, and there were a variety of store cases that we also continued to be involved with. But we saw that the courts started going out, not the courts, we saw that the environment, the legal environment, started going after artists as well. Palma Rides was the artist behind the Fabulous Furry Freak Brothers, and he was assessed taxes by the California State Board of Equalization for his original art because they, like the trial court in Illinois, said comics are not items of value, where the trial court in Illinois was saying that they were not, they should not have the First Amendment rights and were not entitled to certain protections and were obscene. Here the court was saying they weren't art at all. They were saying that his original art was a commercial product that was subject to sales tax because he provided it to a printer to a publisher that printed it. So Morita's paid the tax, but over the course of years fought against the notion that the comic books were merely commercial pieces like a what's a commercial piece? Sorry guys, it's Saturday. He was basically told it wasn't art, and he fought against that notion and basically had to explain that this is a literary manuscript. After 5 years and $70,000 in expenses, he finally claimed victory. In a 3-2 vote, the state BOE agreed to qualify comic book artwork as a legitimate manuscript, but if he lost, cartoonists and publishers would be taxed for getting ideas to you. He came to the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund for aid because he's an underground cartoonist who's taken on this fight that basically was saying the art that we love is, you know, a taco that you're going to buy and that you've got to pay tax to make these ideas. The notion of taxing creative people for the expression of ideas is really anathema to the First Amendment, and it was Paul's courage to stand up to that fight that made a difference, and the fund and our early community of donors helped fight in a way to make that happen. Everybody get a chance to read that? Concurrently, a very chilling case began in Florida, and it was another case where we saw authorities going after an artist. And this, to this day, is probably one of the most iconic cases that the fund has had to fight. Mike Diana, an underground cartoonist, was the controversial creator of the zine Boiled Angel, and he was the first American artist to ever be convicted of obscenity. His work contains graphic and often shocking depictions of society problems. And after a legal battle, he was convicted and not allowed to draw in his own home. Mike came to us fairly early on and was targeted. Targeted because his work was dealing with taboos in the 1990s zine culture. And this work got him targeted by an undercover police officer who began corresponding with him through the mails and earned his trust and ultimately bought his comics. And in buying the comics, set up a sting saying that the comics that Mike made were obscene and just pulled him into the meat grinder of the courts. In a week-long case in 94, the jury found Mike guilty of publishing, distributing, and advertising obscene material. They said that his work lacked serious artistic, political, or scientific value because it didn't compare to the works of the Grapes of Wrath or Guernica. And again, this gets into the notion of the court having no place to be critics of art and to say that work is of high or low value. Either the First Amendment protects the right to expression or it doesn't. And this was a really serious miscarriage of justice. And though the fund threw in our best resources and threw in the money to defend the case, there was just no arguing with the simplistic argument of the prosecutor, where the jury had to go, it's not Grapes of Wrath, and it kind of offends me, so I guess we are going to have to convict it. Diana was sentenced to a 3-year probation period, during which time he was subject to inspection of his home without warning to determine if he was in possession of or creating obscene material. He wasn't allowed to draw in his own home. He couldn't have any contact with people under 18. He had to undergo psychological testing and enroll in journalistic ethics course at his own expense. He had to pay a fine and perform over 1,000 hours of community service. The case was appealed twice, but the Florida Appellate Court failed to reverse the decision or rehear the case. During the first appeal, the prosecution used evidence gathered after the original trial, which is certainly controversial and unethical. The court refused to accept an amicus brief submitted by the ACLU and responded without comment to the final appeal. In May 97, the fund and the ACLU submitted a petition to the U.S. Supreme Court to hear the case. The court also denied the petition and didn't comment, ending all possibility of overturning Mike's conviction. It's a really horrible example of one of the ongoing threads of the CBLDF's work, and that's the human cost of all of these cases. We fight for two reasons. We fight because these laws and these cases that would affect our ability to expand and protect freedom of expression can affect everybody, and you've got to defend the fringes as well as to protect the overall art form. But also, we fight because real people are caught up in this horrible circumstance where the courts are coming after you, you're facing tens of thousands of dollars that you probably don't have, and you've got no recourse to protect yourself. The fund works stridently to ensure that there is a line of defense. In the mid-90s, we saw another case against the comic book stores. Responding to a complaint from an obscenity watchdog group, the Oklahoma City Police Department sent undercover officers into Planet Comics to purchase comics from an adults-only section. Echoes of Friendly Frank's. Later that month, the police raided the store, confiscating several bags of comics and taking store owners Mike Kennedy and John Hunter away in handcuffs. They were charged with 4 felonies and 4 misdemeanors for the sale of adult comics to adults. They carried a maximum prison sentence of up to 43 years in prison. Again, the human cost. You're a retailer, you're selling to a community, and you understand your community, and people that don't understand you are saying that the stuff that you're selling is a criminal act, and you're drug out of your place of business in handcuffs for selling adult work to an adult. It was a horrifying thing. They were classified as dangerous criminals. Their bail was set at $20,000. Their first phone call was to the CBLDF. We immediately paid $2,000 to a bail bondsman to secure their release and hired expert counsel that was able to knock out 4 misdemeanors and 2 felonies. The 2 remaining counts of trafficking and obscenity remained, carrying a sentence of 3 to 5 years in prison. Meanwhile, Planet was evicted from its location, and police raided Hunter's home, confiscating his computer and the storage device of the day, 250 disks. After facing that adversity, they had to shut their doors for the last time in March 96. The state delayed the hearing and delayed the hearing and delayed the hearing until, after all of this time stuck in the legal meat grinder before the trial, the store owners decided, against the advice of CBLDF, to plead guilty to 2 felony charges of trafficking and obscenity for selling Veronica No. 4. They were granted a 3-year deferred sentence and fined $1,500 each. We weren't notified. If we were, we would have tried to talk them out of it. We would have said we would have taken them and told them about the experts we had at their disposal, and we would have tried to fight for the comic book art form there. But ultimately, in these cases, the human toll sometimes takes its toll, and people just decide, I've got to fold and quit. It was a shame, and it didn't set a binding legal precedent, but it did show just how horrible these cases could be. The Winter Brothers case was happening at the same time. This was another attack on artists. The 90s were just full of attacks on comics. Comics were just not seen as having a high value. And the rock duo Johnny and Edgar Winter were sued by sued the artists Joe Lansdale, Tim Truman, and Sam Glanzman for their satirical depiction in the Jonah Hex series, Riders of the Worm and such. At issue was the satirical Autumn Brothers, half-human, half-worm creatures who engaged in criminal and immoral acts. They slapped a lawsuit on the artists alleging defamation, invasion of privacy, and intentional infliction of emotional distress. We came to their aid when they were sued. Ultimately, DC took responsibility over the case, and it took years of legal proceedings to get through the courts and prove that this material had First Amendment value. But the fight wasn't over. The Winters launched an appeal that rose up to the California Supreme Court. First motion of appeal affirmed the victory for DC and the creators, but the petition of the California court sent the case back to be heard by the appeals court. Ultimately, the discussion of was whether the art depicting the celebrities must be transformative to be a violation of the right of publicity. The Supreme Court eventually affirmed that the Autumn Brothers were transformative and protected by the First Amendment. What this means is, did the use of the satire merit First Amendment defense, and also, did the use of the satire convert the characters enough to be protected by the First Amendment? In 2000, San Francisco small press cartoonist Kieran Dwyer took aim at the coffee company Starbucks. This is a famous case as well, where he was satirizing the corporate bully that he saw moving into his neighborhood with a pretty gentle satire depicting the mermaid with dollar signs in her eyes ringed by the words consumer whore. He offered a small run of t-shirts and mugs and just basically was poking fun at the bully that was coming to town. Starbucks decided to completely drop the hammer on him and protested vehemently with a lawsuit. Instead of contacting the artist with a cease and desist, they filed suit immediately with a restraining order, attempting to seize all of his comics and force damages. They wanted him to turn over all of the items he produced, to pull them off his website, and to pay the attorney's fees for them. In the words of Dwyer's lawyer, it was like carpet bombing an anthill. In the midst of all of this, Kieran came to us for help. We helped fund Kieran's attorney in arguing that his client's parody of the Starbucks logo was protected by the First Amendment, and the court agreed that the logo did not infringe on Starbucks' copyright. Unfortunately, the court saw the trademark issue as ambiguous. Starbucks continued that the logo tarnished their trademark and should not be permitted for use in a commercial context. Wanting to avoid a battle with Starbucks, the human toll took its cost once again. Dwyer settled out of court. He continued to display the parody logo, but it was so narrow that nobody would ever see it again. Another brutal case in 2000. Jesus Castillo, a clerk at Keith's Comics in Dallas, was arrested and charged with two counts of obscenity for selling manga to an undercover police officer. Again, adult walks into adults-only section of the store, buys an adult comic from an adult, slaps handcuffs on him. Even though the cover of the offending comic did not depict nudity or sexual content and carried a warning that said, absolutely not for children, police pursued the obscenity arrest. We came to Jesus' aid. We found lawyers and we paid for them. We brought artistic experts to court, including Scott McCloud and Susan Napier, a professor of Asian studies. Prosecutors didn't offer experts, and they scoffed, I don't care what type of evidence or what type of testimony is out there. Use your common sense. Comic books, what we think of as comics, are for kids. They offered no experts to refute ours. And the jury, instead of weighing the expert's testimony more heavily, decided, well, no, comics are for kids. And they sentenced him to 180 days in jail, a $4,000 fine, and 1 year of probation. We immediately appealed. Unfortunately, the results were disappointing. In 2002, the appeals court rendered a 2-1 decision upholding the conviction. The dissenting justice would have reversed on the ground that the state did not provide sufficient evidence that Castillo understood the content and character of the comic. He had to have intent. Based on the dissent, we filed a petition for discretionary review to the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals, the higher court, and that was denied. We then petitioned the U.S. Supreme Court to hear the case, and it was denied again. We did start to see some victories happen in that time, though. Most of the victories in our period you didn't hear about in these cases because they went away in the course of our letters to the police authorities saying this stuff is protected by the First Amendment. We prevented the cases before they started. Here we have a case with Kraft and Helm where another big corporation is going after another small artist saying that he can't use the satirical name that he signed his work under, King Velveeta, and that he'd been signing his work under for more than a decade. Helm said, no, that doesn't sound right. I've been doing this for a decade. These are parody. Kraft ultimately decided to sue him, and then he called us after he got the suit and said, hey guys, what can you do to help us? After agreeing to personally handle Stu's defense, Bert Joseph said, this case represents a $2 billion corporation trying to push the envelope and restricting the use of anything that ridicules a trademark. In 2002, Magistrate Judge Arlinder Keyes granted Kraft's request for a preliminary injunction and forced Helm to remove the King Velveeta moniker. Helm complied with the ruling, but we filed an appeal. Ultimately, Kraft decided that this is taking too much of their resources and ultimately was not something they wanted to continue to pursue. Helm agreed to stop signing the work with the King Velveeta moniker, but not until he was granted 5 years to sell off his art. In turn, Kraft agreed to give a large donation to the Freedom to Read Foundation. Helm said ultimately, when they started, they gave me 30 days to cease and desist doing anything with my nickname. Now, 1 year later, I have 5 years to sell my artwork. I don't owe them any money, and a good cause is getting paid. A bright side. In 2004, Customs in South Carolina seized copies of the comic Strip Burger. They alleged that Richie Bush, satirizing the Bush administration, and Maj Stube, a parody, an ecological parody, were pirated versions of copyrighted comics. Richie Bush poked fun at the Bush administration, and I think around that period we just had a customs guard go, huh, this personally offends me. And the fund went in and said, nope, this is protected work, and you need to let this into the country. Ultimately, we successfully challenged and won. Another successful challenge in that window is Georgia versus Gordon Lee. This is a case where police went into a small comic shop owner and said that a comic book involving the depiction, the factual depiction of the meeting between George Brock and Pablo Picasso, was harmful to minors. It depicted Picasso answering Dorn the Nude. It was a depiction of an artist who was so engrossed in his art that he didn't recognize his own state of nudity. He was targeted for the offense and endured 3 years of mistreatment by local prosecutors. He was charged with 2 felony counts and 5 misdemeanor counts. He called us and we knocked out the misdemeanors, and then we went to court on the felonies. After 18 months, getting all of our resources ready, getting our experts ready, being there for trial, they called us 12 hours before the court was to start and said, we have the wrong victim, and we're going to have to go back to start. So first they changed their facts. They alleged that the victim that had gotten the comic that they alleged to be harmful to minors was somebody else. Months later, they threw that out because of procedural error and brought a new indictment. When Lee eventually got to trial in November 2007, in the opening statements, the prosecutors created a mistrial. They were basically trying to outspend him and make him go away for doing something that wasn't wrong. After 3 years and $100,000 were spent on the defense, prosecutors settled for what Lee originally offered, a letter of apology. Last year, we saw a really sad case develop, U.S. v. Hanley, and this is where the courts are going now. Chris Hanley, a manga collector, had pled guilty to possessing manga that the government alleged was child pornographic, and that he felt was part of an art tradition, but facing a mandatory minimum sentence, he determined that it was in his interest to take a plea deal. He was sentenced to 6 months in prison to be followed by 3 years of supervised release running concurrent with the 5 years of probation. It was the first time a comic book reader was sent to prison for owning comics. Unfortunately, the CBLDF didn't manage the case. We did prepare expert testimony on his behalf, but unfortunately Hanley chose not to fight. Cases of this nature are becoming more common. I'm going to skip that. Like right now, we have a case involving an American citizen who we're calling Brandon, who flew to visit a friend in Canada, and upon arrival was searched and had all of his materials, including his laptop, his iPad, and his iPhone, searched by customs. The officer discovered the manga on his laptop and went, "Huh, this looks suspicious. I'm going to send it to my boss." His boss looked at the manga and said, "Huh, this is depicting weird stick figures engaged in sexual material. This looks weird. I'm going to send it to my boss." His boss said, "I think this is child pornography. We're going to send this to the courts." Brandon's real name is being withheld because that false accusation could ruin his life, take away his job. He came to the fund and said, "What can you do to help?" We decided that, as a board, that nobody should go to jail for comic books, and this artwork, which depicts work from a foreign art tradition, is not photographic evidence of a crime. That's what child pornography is. This is expressive art and needs to be defended. And so right now we're facing a legal bill of up to $150,000 to defend an individual for owning art. Right now you don't have any recourse at customs. It's an unusual occurrence, and so they can search through anything, including your devices, including your computer, including your data. This is going to be an important fight moving ahead, and the fund is committed to doing everything we can to raise money for it. So for 25 years, we've taken our resources that are developed, $5 at a time, $10 at a time, from folks like yourselves here in this room, and we've hired counsel that goes out and fights on behalf of the comic book art form and the people who make it and the people who read it. In the last 50 years, we've seen a shift where first the authorities were going after the publishers, and then they were going after the stores, and now they're going after the readers for material they disagree with. In the 70s, 80s, and 90s, we saw the specter of obscenity being brought against people, and that taboo of this person is selling obscene material and is a pornographer for selling obscene material, intimidating speech that dealt with adult subject matter. Today, we're seeing that obscenity is not the phrase that they're using, but they're accusing expressive art of being child pornography, which is such a loaded phrase that the minute you utter it, you're on such a defensive that people have already decided that you're at least creepy, if not guilty. These are the stakes in the 21st century to protect expressive art, and the fund is committed to it. We've won some and we've lost some, and most of what we've showed you today involve the cases that were either lost or were not 100% great, because those are the cases that are the most chilling and that indicate the greatest human cost, the human beings that are being mowed down by the system that did not have their most successful day in court, but at least weren't completely destroyed because somebody was there to stand up for them. But we've also showed you cases like Gordon Lee and Paul Mavridis, where through diligence, through right action, through working hard, and through having the support of the community, we were able to score a win. It's a shame with Chris Hanley that he decided to plead guilty, because I think we had a really good shot at protecting his case and in proving that there was artistic merit there. We're hoping with Brandon to have an opportunity to prove, beyond the shadow of a doubt, that nobody should go to jail for comics, and that expression, free expression, helps us advance as a culture. And so we hope for your help, and we thank you for coming out and being interested in our work. I have 2 minutes for questions, and there was somebody real patient back there. Is he still here? Yeah.
What is the motivation of the people who are bringing up these cases?
I don't speculate on the motives of prosecutors, because that's just a deep well that there's no getting out of. But ultimately, what you do see are moral panics that occur. The case I skipped in here for time, Schwarzenegger v. EMA, was a California case that just had a successful result in the U.S. Supreme Court, where We brought to the attention of the court the history of the comics in the 50s and how that moral panic really decimated our art form. And Scalia agreed and basically said in his majority that moral panics attempting to censor content on grounds that are personal really have no place in the First Amendment. And so oftentimes you'll see cases because somebody just is offended or disagrees. You'll see cases where communities like the one in Georgia will just try to intimidate an individual out of town by outspending him. It's but again, it just varies from case to case, and it's unwise to speculate on the motives of the opponents of free expression and wise to join hands and to fight back against the forces that want to tell you what to read, create, or think. I have time for exactly one more over here.
Yeah, it's illegal for minors to engage in sexual activity. It's illegal to possess photography, even though photographers themselves would claim that their work is art as well, of minors engaging in sexual activity. Why should it not be illegal for that same depiction done as a norm?
First of all, I'm not sure it's true that it's illegal for minors to engage in sexual activity, but that's a point for lawyers. Child pornography is photographic evidence of a crime. That's the bottom line. Child pornography, the government's interest is to prevent real people from being victimized in a fashion that is repugnant. And when you move the goalpost to take a depiction of minors engaged in sexual activity, which happens, you're creating a realm of thought crime, and you're creating a realm where the artistic depiction of things that happen, the serious description of things that happen, such as we see in Phoebe Glockner's comics, such as we see in Ariel Schrag's memoir comics, such as we see in Alan Moore's Lost Girls, are targeted in ways that are trying to take the choice out of your hands as a reader and put them in the hands of the courts. And ultimately, that's not what these laws are for. These laws are to prevent real people from being harmed. Okay. Thanks, everybody. We can talk more on our booth.